Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Christopher Hitchens has never been a friend to religion. The sharp-tongued, British-born critic and provocateur called Mother Teresa the ghoul of Calcutta. He was early and loud in denouncing Islamic fascism. He's a dukes-up on all fronts, anti-theist. With his new book, the gloves are really off. He's called it God is Not Great. Subtitle, How Religion Poisons Everything. You may love it, billions do, but Hitchens calls organized faith violent, irrational, intolerant, allied to racism, tribalism, and bigotry. And that's just for starters. Up next on Point, Christopher Hitchens versus God. We'll be joined in a few minutes by an Indiana evangelical megachurch leader and a Wake Forest Baptist theologian. But first, joining me from Washington is author, journalist, critic, and all-around provocative thinker Christopher Hitchens, British-born, a U.S. citizen as of last month, a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and through his writing all over. His new book is God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Christopher Hitchens, welcome.
Nice of you to have me.
You took on Al Sharpton in New York Monday night. Did he change your mind?
Not exactly. He didn't try either. I mean, he's a man...
The Reverend Al Sharpton.
I wouldn't say that, though I think Reverend is a title to live down rather than to live up to. I still would rather call him Mr. If anyone exemplifies what one sometimes suspects about this business, that's all it is for some people, that it's a trade, he does. And he's a sort of Chaucerian fraud and mountebank. He must wake up every morning just pinching himself. Can't believe his luck.
I
call attention to a fact that, since you raised his name, that might form part of our deliberations. Everybody knows that Sharpton is a racist and a thug and a demagogue and a bully and all of the rest of it. But because he's called Reverend, he's allowed to get away with an extraordinary number of things. In this society, if you can get yourself called a man of faith, in other words, a person who believes things without evidence, you are given an axiomatic privilege.
Did you say all that Monday night? He's a thug, he's a racist? Or are you getting away with it now that the debate's over?
That's part of what I'm criticizing in this book, the presumption that faith is a virtue. Good question. Mr. Sharpton knows what I think about him, but he was, as it were, my guest on Monday night.
And so not.
We had an agreement to be icily polite with each other. In other words, we debated the issues rather than each other's shortcomings.
And you, a brand new U.S. citizen at 58 years of age. I want to get to the substance of the book, but what about your choice to do that? I mean, this is one of the most famously religious countries on earth. You are, for a long time, been famously anti-religion, and now putting it just as bluntly as possible. Did it give you any second thoughts about becoming a citizen in this very God-fearing country?
I took my oath of allegiance at the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., on Friday the 13th of April, which is Mr. Jefferson's birthday. It's also mine by nice coincidence, at least nice for me. I'm his biographer in a small way.
Yes.
And as well as renouncing foreign princes and all the other enjoyable parts of the oath, in my remarks, I did call attention to his authorship of the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom, the basis of our fantastically beautiful First Amendment to the Constitution, and to his general skepticism in matters religious, and point out that it's only in the United States that there's a constitution that separates the church from the state, with a famous wall, as Mr. Jefferson once put it. Mm-hmm. In fact, my new campaign slogan is, Mr. Jefferson, build up that wall.
And take that, Ronald Reagan.
For this being the most religious country, well, I frankly don't believe this stuff. I mean, people publish fantastic opinion polls that say things like 90% of Americans believe in Satan or something of the sort, and 80% of them go to church. It's simply not true.
You've been to a church lately? These mega churches? They're filled to the brim, to the gills.
No, I don't go to the. I do not go to these pest houses.
But it's not a poll. It's people vote with their feet.
No. I do stand in the middle of town on Sunday mornings, and I notice it's not 20% of the population on the street. It's just these things. It's not true. even in places like Oklahoma and Kansas and Texas and the most conservative district of Pennsylvania around the town of Dover, the intelligent design people have been humiliated in court and voted off the school boards every time they've tried it. It's not true that more Americans believe in creation than in Darwinism. They lie to the pollsters when they say about their personal faith, a great number of them, in my opinion. And there must be a reason for the thing you mentioned in our opening bid, what you rightly call the backlash. I mean, my book is immediately high on the bestseller list before I've really had a chance to launch it, and great though its merits are, and mine too, I know that's not the reason. It's part of a movement that was identified with other authors more eminent than myself, Professors Dawkins and Dennett, for example.
We've heard from
and
them.
It's part of a change in the zeitgeist. I think there are a lot of people, a very great number of people, they come to my meetings every night, who are fed up with religious bullying and coercion and clerical lecturing and with the damage being done to civilization by faith. And they want to find a way of pushing back at it.
We're going to hear pushback on exactly that front. You wield the saber like few others here, just as blunt and provocative as you can be. God is not great. I mean, I guess that's a jab at every God-fearing person, and Islam in particular, how religion poisons everything. The subtitle, you couldn't get tougher than that. Make your case. We're going to hear in a moment from a megachurch evangelical minister who I am sure does not share that view. Begin to line it out for us, Christopher Hitchens. What's the problem with religion?
Well, there are two problems. The first is the belief itself, if you like, that the universe and we are created with a purpose in mind. Apparently, we're to assume a benign one. Religion comes from the terrified infancy of our species when, since we still had to search for explanations, our brains have no choice but to do that. We are so made. We had to search for explanations in the absence of knowledge. We didn't know that the sun went round the earth. We weren't going to find that out as far as the church was concerned either. We didn't know that there was a germ theory of disease to explain plagues and maladies. We had no concept at all of the cosmos. Well, it shows the shortcomings of a religion that evolved in those circumstances. So the first thing is it's not true. And it's not even wrong, actually. It has no relationship to any of the inquiries and investigations we need to make in order to know something about our origins and our place in the cosmos. The second thing is that those who believe this, or believe the supernatural explanation of it, further believe they know the mind of God. They are in private communication. They know, for example, some of them claim to know that he doesn't like ham. They know him that well.
Don't eat pork.
They know him well enough to be able to issue commandments in his name saying that one may not, for example, masturbate or go to bed with a person of the same sex or of the opposite sex unless under very strict regulated conditions. How they know this, I don't know. They've never been able to furnish the relevant information, but it does mean that religion is innately coercive as well as innately incoherent. Because it's man-made, there is an infinite variety of it, furthermore, and these sects proceed to quarrel among themselves, religious warfare having been one of the great retardants of civilization or of the time we've been alive and very much to this day. There is finally a better tradition, it seems to me, that goes back as far as we know to Epicurus and Democritus and Lucretius and the people who first worked out that the universe was made of atoms and that there was no personal God who intervened or took any interest in our doings. And though some people find that a depressing conclusion, it's actually led to some rather wonderful work and some rather beautiful discoveries from Galileo, who was a student of Democritus, through Spinoza, a near-perfect philosophical mind, through Mr. Jefferson, the great humanist polymath.
You're looking at reason, enlightenment.
Albert Einstein, yes. The beauties of science, the beauties of reason, the wonderful discoveries that one can see through the Hubble telescope, far more magnificent than any burning bush. The consolations of philosophy, which are not negligible. We have a much finer tradition than those of the rival muttering priesthoods.
But poison poisons everything? Is it as insidious as that?
I think any even small dose of the sleep of reason, even when reason nods off for a second, unreason and barbarism are waiting to rush in. It's a full-time job, just keeping the mind alive in the face of these challenges from superstition and irrationality.
Are you an equal opportunity offender? Is it every faith, every religion that you're leveling this charge at?
Well, they're all equal glimpses of the same untruth, and they all demand the surrender of reason, and they all assert impossible things with no evidence, and they all hope for an everlasting dictatorship. I mean, religion is, among other things, I should have said this earlier, provides us with a great insight into the origins of totalitarianism. What would it be like if it was true? I mean, I'm an anti-theist, remember, as you kindly said in the introduction. It's not. You could be an atheist and wish, nonetheless, that the evidence would support the existence of such a system. I don't, because it would be like demanding to live in a celestial North Korea, where you are completely supervised and invigilated without let-up every instant of your life from conception until death, and that's when the fun really begins. Because you either go to a paradise which, according to every description I have ever read, would be hellish, consisting of eternal praise and perfect servitude, unending and benign, worst of all, a benign dictatorship, or you go for a lifetime of torture for an offence that you probably couldn't have failed to commit because, as was well said about religion once, it postulates that we're created diseased and then ordered to be well.
Christopher Hitchens.
This is a disgusting idea.
Christopher Hitchens, let's take a call from Camille in Charleston, South Carolina. Camille, you're on the air.
Hi. I actually agree with most of what your guest is saying. However, there is an aspect to it in which I do not, and that aspect being equating religion and God is the same thing.
You say they're different?
Oh, well, I think I know what she means. Yes, they are different. I mean, as I've said, you can believe in God. You can be a deist, as Thomas Jefferson was, for example. It was very common among enlightened people of that part of the 18th century. And they thought, look, this is pre-Darwin, pre-Einstein. Darwin wasn't going to be born till the same day as Abraham Lincoln, funnily enough. Look, it does seem as if there's an order to the known universe, as if it has some predictable rhythms, it seems to have a pattern. So it's very difficult to think that there's no designer involved here.
Can an anti-theist be a deist?
Sorry?
Can an anti-theist like you be a deist like Jefferson?
Well,
just
give me a second.
Yeah.
So you can believe that that's the case, but you're not a religious person because you don't think that God gives you instructions or intervenes in the human life. Religion means that you claim that you know God's mind. It's an impossibly grandiose claim, but many people think they can make it. An anti-theist says that it would be horrible if it was true, but fortunately there is less than zero evidence for it.
For what?
And for the proposition that there's a creator.
So Jefferson...
As for the proposition that there's a creator who intervenes, ludicrous proposition, so... One simply adds to the dismissal of the hypothesis that one dismisses it with great relief because of the horrific nature of the horrific character of the regime of totalitarianism that would be implied if the false claims of religion were valid.
So maybe they're not the same thing, but you're not eager to dive in there anyway. Let's get another call from Sherry, Portsmouth, Virginia. Sherry, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call.
Certainly.
Having been raised in the South here in Virginia, and I'm an African American,
mm-hmm.
I've always viewed religion as being something that was used to pacify slaves, and so it continues into the present day that it was created by slaveholders basically to pacify slaves on earth so they could deal with the suffering of slavery and then ultimately get their heaven in the afterlife. And I see that is still holding us back in the 21st century because we have a great deal of people who are willing to allow anything to happen in the name of God as a way of being able to sort of deal with the continued inequities of the legacy of slavery.
But do you see no countervailing benefit from religion? I mean, it may have been used that way, but could it still not be valuable in some way, Sherry?
Well, I mean, certainly, I mean, it is the opiate of the masses in many ways. And yes, with all of the problems and trials and tribulations that we face, it is a way of keeping people, I think, from just running into the streets screaming insanely, because it is a way of being able to avoid the reality of what we have to deal with. And what I think that what happens, it allows people to live in an Alice in Wonderland kind of world, because everything will be okay if we just kind of give it over to God, as opposed to actually dealing with the issues. And so, and I guess in essence, no, I don't think that it's really helpful at this point, because it allows people to avoid the consequences and the reality of what they need to be dealing with.
Sherry, thanks for your call. Christopher Hitchens, poisons everything, including race relations, make slaves.
Well, I mean, there's a tough lady, I must say. Of course, she's right that things like vicarious redemption, the idea that you cannot just have your sins forgiven, but have them cancelled altogether by the suffering of another person,
Jesus.
Yes, is a horrible scapegoating idea. I mean, I can offer to pay your debt if you've run out of money, or I could offer, if I really loved you, to take your turn and serve your time in prison, but I cannot relieve you of your responsibilities. I can't say you didn't commit this sin. I can't forgive you in that sense, and I can't certainly offer to do so by means of a disgusting human sacrifice. I mean, this is an abdication of responsibility, in my view. I would, if asked, say that some Christians had played a very important role in abolishing slavery and also in forwarding the cause of civil rights. In my book, I say that they didn't need to be Christian to do this, and that the case for abolishing slavery and for civil rights had been made for a long time by secularists and by unbelievers. But
the fact that believers carried the torch and made it happen,
nonetheless,
counts for nothing?
I think one must give credit to those who did do so, though it's very difficult to connect it actually to their beliefs, because there's nothing in the Old or New Testament that says slaves should be free. There's just a great deal that says there should be slavery. So I can see why it took them a long time to get round to demanding this in the name of God, because the evidence is the other way.
Mm. Sherry,
the New Testament contains the warrant for slavery.
Yeah. Sherry, thanks.
The Old Testament contains the warrant for slavery.
Right. I want to turn to the prose here for a minute, if I can. You've given it plenty of thought and a lot of ink. Sherry, thanks for your call. I want to go now to Munster, Indiana, and to Stephen Muncy. He's senior pastor of the Family Christian Center, a 10,000-member megachurch there. He's author of Unleashing Your God-Given Dreams. He's been listening. Reverend Stephen Muncy, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So here we've got a kind of soup-to-nuts slashing critique of not just Christianity but all religion by Christopher Hitchens. You've been listening. He says it's not true, it's coercive, it's a source of violence, there's a better way, reason. What do you say, Pastor?
Well, first of all, Christopher Hitchens is absolutely incredibly talented. All of his other books are great. I love his writings. But he's dead wrong on this one. And the reason why is because he can't go up against the testimony of believers. Because he believes something, I believe something, we will stand at the pulpits or podiums, and we will debate because our belief systems have experienced and produces a testimony.
And so you believe what he doesn't, and you see it just as a standoff, a face-off. Is that
definitely
satisfactory?
Because he's out to prove that my testimony and my salutations of my belief in a God is dead wrong. And I do agree with him on the fact that I think religion has poisoned a lot of things, because religion is a man-made issue. But when it comes to believing in a deity, he has to ask himself this question in all of his studies, which he's a great writer, and this book is well written because I read the book, that there is no culture, no city, no kingdom that has ever been created or ever been in history that there has not been prayers, oath, oracles, sacrifices that men have prayed or believed in something of a higher power.
Does that prove that it's right and good, or is that what you're saying, because it's always existed?
It's always existed.
But does that prove that it's right and good?
Well, I believe that man desires and believes and senses there's something higher than him. whether it's good or evil.
Christopher Hitchens, Stephen Muncy's in the lion's den with you. You hear his argument.
Well, thank you for your very handsome remarks, by the way, at the beginning. I think that it's true that people want something that one might call transcendent. I would prefer not to say spiritual. Transcendent, or the other word that's, I think that's accurate to describe it, as far as one can use this accurately, numinous, something beyond the obvious or the visible. I wouldn't trust anyone who didn't have that feeling, who didn't sometimes say, well, I don't know how much of a Wordsworth fan you are, but suppose a sunset on the lake, or if you're a mountain climber, you know the sort of thing I'm talking about, or if you're not the outdoors type, or the nature worshipper, sitting, as I remember once doing in King's College Chapel, one of the marvels of Gothic architecture in Cambridge in England.
But Stephen Muncy isn't just talking about awe.
He's talking about belief. He didn't say anything about belief.
Yes, he did. The testimony of believers.
Yeah, well, he didn't succeed in saying anything in its defense.
But you and I know it's not just a pretty sunset he's talking about. He's got 10,000 people in his church who don't come just for pretty sunsets.
Sorry, perhaps I should have said I'm answering his points in reverse order. I'm just taking him up on the transcendent. Yes, people do need it. There are many of us who can find that, too, in religion, in devotional music, religious music, if you like, and even in religious painting and architecture, and in my case, poems of, say, John Donne or George Herbert. I wouldn't be without them. But I don't believe that there's any supernatural influence. And I can't believe it, and there are quite a number of us who are that way. Blaise Pascal actually addressed his pensée to us, those who are so made that they cannot believe. Now, that's also been just as true throughout human history, that there have been people who say, no, there aren't any gods. Usually they've been put on trial for it and been persecuted and tortured and condemned for it from the trial of Socrates onwards. But there it is.
These are the
contending schools of thought who we both, in our respective ways, represent.
Stephen Muncy?
Mr. Hitchens, in your writings, I applaud you, especially with the Islam. And I saw you on Bill Maher, and I tell you what, I was very proud of you when you had understanding of that, which I'm totally in disagreement with their views. And then I've noticed you've taken trips to different parts of the world, and you've been appalled what men have done in the name of religion. And I think there's been a mix-up where we say God and religion, but I want to give you a testimony of my 11-year-old daughter, who I thought she had the flu or pneumonia. Come to find out, she had, in X-rays, in a matter of 24 hours, 100% Hodgkin's disease in her lungs. So the doctor tells us, by the best doctors in Chicago, she's going to die in 3 months. So we put chemotherapy in her. She loses her hair. She loses all of her. Now I'm a minister of 10,000 people who I teach them about God, and I also teach that I believe the God that I serve can heal. So now I'm put on trial on my belief system for my little girl, and she's dying in front of me. Now she's days away from death. All the medicines and the best doctors have done their duty, which we are thankful. I kneel down. I put my hand on her hand. I ask God, would you heal my baby? Mysteriously, supernaturally, whatever you want to call it, my testimony is that she lives today. That was 4 years ago. Doctors are amazed. You've come too late to me, Christopher Hitchens, to tell me that was not an act of a real God.
Are you going to call this father, Christopher Hitchens, a charlatan, a fool, with that testimony?
Well, it's a flat-out unbelievable testimony. And it's been the basis of religious charlatanry all along, to say that...
Do you doubt the story, though? I mean, he...
Well, I know the
experience of it.
I do know... I'm very sorry if I sound callous, but I do know of a lot of children who've died horribly, despite having been prayed over with extreme fervency. And I think it's disgusting to suppose that those prayers were inferior to other people's. And I further think it's irrational to say that if something has no apparent natural explanation, it must have a supernatural one. There are such things as unexpected recoveries, though it does seem to me she's had a long course of treatment. In fact, it was the first thing that the Reverend mentioned. But to claim that you have a personal line to God and that he'll intervene for your convenience is a disgraceful thing to say, in my view.
Wow.
And an insult to those whose children continue to suffer.
But Mr.
Despite
Hitchens,
despite agonies of prayer on their behalf.
This is
a conscious attempt to defraud people.
It's
the basis of a great deal of religious hucksterism.
As well as being
immoral, it's highly unattractive.
Stephen Munsey?
Mr. Hitchens, the key is that it's not fair upon this planet to human mankind to discredit a personal testimony and then to try to encumber ideas of because someone else I know nothing of or about, you cannot take that away from me. What about the thousands of people that continue to come? I can't beg people to come. I don't plead with people to come. I'm building on and on and on, and people's lives are being changed, and they credit it to God.
Mm. Christopher Hitchens, it's his experience. He believes it, and they come by the thousands. There's a need.
Yeah, if this wasn't so, there'd be no need for books saying that it was nonsense.
What about the need that drives them? To his church, to
well, absolutely. It's the same need that drives people to blow up each other's mosques in Iraq and say that God made them do it. That's testimony, isn't it? It's the same need that makes people think they see statues of the Virgin Mary bleed or weep when statues don't, in fact, do that.
Stephen Munsey?
It's the same need that makes people consult the astrology columns in the magazines because the astrology column will tell you, in spite of your boring and banal life, that the stars are arranged with you in mind.
Pastor Munsey,
It's contemptible, but the people who exploit it and make a trade out of it, a living out of it, are beneath contempt.
And that brings me to the point that when you do believe in higher powers, you must believe in the right one, and the right one does not tell you to blow somebody up. The right one, the God that I'm talking about, tells us to love one another, to help one another, to meet the needs of humanity. I don't know about the God that tells you that, you know, you blow somebody up, you got 25 virgins waiting for you in heaven as a reward.
Plenty of Christian soldiers out there. Pastor Munsey?
Sir?
There are plenty of Christian soldiers out there with guns as well.
Yes.
You're just saying it's a different quality of violence.
I'm expressing that the true God, the real God, and of course, Mr. Hitchens refers to the New Testament that it is not real and that Jesus is not real. The fact is that when you believe that and understand from the Bible, you will understand that we have a God who is merciful, who gives us boundaries. A while ago, Mr. Hitchens says there are some people that believe that God doesn't believe in ham. Well, if you look at the dietary laws of what God expresses, it will help you in life.
Reverend Stephen Munsey, thank you very much for joining us. We're talking this hour with journalist, critic, and newly minted American citizen Christopher Hitchens. His new book is God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, and it comes out in train with a string of books from Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris, a lot of blowback in the publishing world, at least these days, against religion and its impact. Dana's calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Dana, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well. What do you think, Dana?
Well, actually, I think your guest today sounds very educated. Unfortunately, he sounds like an educated fool, in my opinion. Based on his beliefs and how he believes. I'm unsure how you can look at nature and the things that are unexplainable by scientists and unexplainable by mankind and not say that there is a God that has formed these things on Earth.
But is nature unexplainable by scientists?
A lot of things in nature are unexplainable by scientists. They're researching on a lot of issues, and a lot of times they do make theories on things, but a lot of things they're still in the process of researching, and some things they'll never know. Because God is made by someone other than ourselves.
So it's the majesty of creation that you think refutes Christopher Hitchens?
Correct.
The mystery.
The mystery of how things were formed. I mean, yes, we can, philosophers over years have philosophized about how things were formed, and they've asked questions and have gathered answers to these questions that they think is the reason for things and the reason for life. But they have no direct answer for these things.
Christopher Hitchens, Dana listens to you and hears her words, an educated fool.
Well, I shall endeavor not to reply in kind, but I think that it must have been noticed by anyone listening to that repetitive, fallacious little intervention that she seems to imagine that what isn't explained can be explained by her. I mean, I wouldn't presume any such arrogance. But she actually, what have we been wasting our time for with all these inquiries into nature and the natural order? Well, there's a lady in Virginia Beach who knows all about it. We should have asked her. And she even knows who's responsible.
I'm imagining she says she doesn't
and you,
know.
And by the way, isn't it amazing, too, how the religious keep telling you how humble they are and what humility they possess when they make the most fantastically arrogant claims for themselves?
But maybe she would see it as the opposite, that she has the humility not to pretend that she understands all ultimate mystery, that she throws that in the hands of God.
Without specifying anything in particular, she said there's much that's unexplained, but don't worry, because like, she has the explanation for it. She didn't sound to me as if she was qualified to make that call. I don't consider myself qualified to make it either, but I think it's pretty well understood that such advances as we do have in the understanding of nature and of the origins of the cosmos have been very considerable in the last couple of centuries, and they've been made usually in the teeth of religious opposition.
Let's take a call from Lansing, Michigan. Kathy, you're on the air with Christopher Hitchens.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I tend to agree with you. I grew up in the church, and over the course of many years, I have come to the conclusion that once upon a time, religion served a purpose because people didn't know why things happened and they needed to have some feeling that they did know. But at this point, I think humanity needs to grow up. It's ridiculous what people do in the name of something that we don't even see, we don't know exists. It's, you know, it's not tangible. And the things that people do to each other in that name, just it's disgusting.
Grow up, grow out of it, you say. Christopher Hitchens, will that happen?
Well, I think it has happened to a very great extent. I mean, most people live their lives as if we had a secular compromise and a separation of church and state. And they're willing to respect religion as a private belief, but they're not willing to have it intruding into the public sphere, and they're not willing to have nonsense taught to their children in schools. I think that's a reasonable compromise. The reason for the pushback that you and I have both mentioned a couple of times now is because religion insists, and I think it's innate in it myself, in breaking bounds. I mean, after all, if you are like the reverend who we were just talking to, convinced that he knows a way of curing Hodgkin's disease, but no reason at all is given by him to suggest he has any idea why someone gets Hodgkin's disease in the first place. Does God give it to her? He would never allow that. God only takes it away. You see? I think such opinions could be very dangerous, because if people thought that faith could heal, they wouldn't get on with medicine. And whenever people have resorted to the colored water and the miracle cures and so forth, there's been a huge increase in disease. The campaign by the faithful against inoculation, for example, because it was an interference with God's design, is still going on in large parts of the world. It's the reason for the failure of the international anti-polio campaign, for example, and the resurgence of that horrible malady which has destroyed the lives of many more children than have been prayed over in that ludicrous church in Indiana. So you see, it isn't just a difference of opinion. It does have real-world implications, and I think the last caller understands that.
Kathy, Dana, thank you for your calls. I want to turn to a theologian. Joining us from Cincinnati, Ohio, is Bill Leonard. He's professor of church history and dean of the Divinity School at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, an ordained Baptist minister, author of Baptists in America. Dean Leonard, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
You've been listening, you've read the book, you hear the bill of complaint. Christopher Hitchens says religion, not true, coercive, source of violence, there's a better way. What does it leave you thinking?
Well, time's moving quickly, so I'll jump in quickly. One thing, just to thank Mr. Hitchens for the book. I'm probably going to use it as a text next year in some way or another. One of the things I like, it's a fine survey of issues related to world religions and philosophy, and you even know about the burned over district, and I thought there were only three of us in America who knew about it.
So, the burned over district? I'm sorry.
That's another whole issue, but okay. This area of Western New York that was swept by revival fire. So even having that mention caught my attention.
Mm-hmm.
I would say to begin that, one, you're right about a lot of the issues you raise, and it is embarrassing to read it all put together in print for those of us who talk about these things in classes here and yon. I do think you give short shrift, however, to the dissenting tradition, particularly in Christianity. I won't speak about other world religions. You do mention Archbishop Romero, but Sojourner Truth and John Woolman and Bishop Tutu. You sort of write Gustavo Gutierrez and liberation theology off in about two, I think, pretty shallow sentences. And I wonder why. I think one of the reasons that I continue to participate in religious communities is what I learned from the 17th century Baptists, who were also hanging out in Holland in its more tolerant era. And that was this understanding and of an anti-establishmentarianism, this concern for conscience. And so I think you see that that's there, but it, because it doesn't fit your argument, you sort of dismiss this. And I'll give you two quick examples. One is you say, in no real sense, as opposed to nominal sense, was Martin Luther King a Christian? And then you do a similar thing about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, both of whom you admire. King, you give some... raise some interesting questions about, but you seem to know that they weren't, that King wasn't a Christian, or suggest that, and that Bonhoeffer was more of a humanist, and therefore his faith didn't really compute. And so I wonder how you can be critical of people who claim to know the mind of God when you're claiming to know the mind of Bonhoeffer and King. And I think one of the reasons that's difficult for you is because they do represent that dissenting tradition that stands over against this kind of establishmentarian religion that you rightly challenge.
May I, before we go to Christopher Hitchens, may I just check one thing? You're the theologian, you're the ordained Baptist minister, but in your response to this book, are you writing off religion in the main and immediately retreating to the dissenting tradition to defend? Are you saying in the main he's right?
I'm saying that the significant illustrations that he uses clearly reflect what religion becomes, and it's embarrassing to read, of course, because of the way in which a kind of how quickly religion establishes itself and wants to become culture dominant and then set the agendas for everybody
in earthly ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Christopher, he's conceding a lot to you right off the bat, but says you're missing.
I should thank him not only for that extreme honesty and candor on his part, but also for the very generous things he said about my book, and take him up, yes, on the challenge. I say this about Dr. King for the following reason, that he obviously used the language of Exodus, the famous story of the freeing of the Israelites in their wanderings, as a metaphor, as why would he not? It was the only book... or comes from the only book that everyone he knew or could reach had read. The only one they had all of them read.
That is the Bible.
The only story you could count on everyone knowing, yeah. Mm. I say in my book that if he'd chosen the story of Xenophon's Anabasis and the Greeks' long fight upwards and over towards the sea and eventually freedom... it would have been just as good if everyone had been raised on Xenophon.
But isn't that pretty presumptuous of you to say the attestations of religious belief?
Excuse me. No, I didn't say anything.
Well, it's the only book they had that could get their hands on. That's why he chose it instead of Xenophon.
Yes. Well, he would be stupid not to. If he chose Xenophon instead, I don't think he'd got quite the same audience, though he could have made just as convincing a case for civil rights. Now, what does the book of Exodus say? It doesn't just say, let these people go. It says, let them kill everyone who gets in their way and all other tribes. Let them enslave the women, let them destroy the children, let them steal the land of others in Canaan, as long as they make a covenant with an unforgiving God. Now, that's exactly what Dr. King did not offer his congregation. He said, we're not going to reply in kind. Mm. We're not going to be cruel. We're not going to be racist. We're not going to be violent. We refuse all of this. Well, that means that he wasn't invoking the Old Testament properly at all. Empirically also, I think I have some evidence on my side. Dr. King was regularly attacked by the authorities, including a large number of the religious authorities of the day, for surrounding himself with secular people, leftists, socialists, communists, which he did. He seems to have preferred their company. I would not say that I knew his mind, but I'd say that the assumption that he was a believing Christian who actually thought that there was a God on his side and a Savior in his corner and so on is not necessarily warranted. And that, above all, the case for the emancipation of black America had already been completely made by secularists and doesn't require any supernatural warrant.
And with that, if we accept that, do you also write off the entire dissenting tradition Bill Leonard talks about? Do you deny that there's a kernel? Yes, please, Bill.
Really quickly, yeah. Again, when you read Stride Toward Freedom, probably the most famous passage in one of the few books that King wrote is where he sits at the kitchen table in the wee hours of the morning. He's had multiple bomb threats, and he says, I'm going to give it up. My family's endangered. And he hears the voice, and he speaks that speaks to him and says, stand up for freedom, stand up for courage. It's one of the most famous and seems to be, at least in his own mind, a pivotal point. And it is a transcendent moment that he attributes to the divine. So I think, again, it's pushing...
He's perfectly free to do that, but of course. But, I mean, I wouldn't say, frankly, that I hadn't heard that voice myself on occasions, not in any such dramatic or dangerous circumstances, but in some tough places and at some tough times where I've thought, oh, the hell with this, and something tells me, no, come on, pull yourself together. You have to get going on
this. And he exists.
And you can't let, or you can't watch that happen. You must intervene. I mean, any moral person has promptings of that kind.
He exists in a community, lives in a community where he does attribute that in ways that shape him. Just a quick correction to you. I think you're really wrong when you say King could not out-preach the rednecks. That's page 179. He did out-preach the rednecks, and that's what terrified a great many of the preachers in the South who were segregationists. Mm-hmm.
Bill, Christopher Hitchens, let me get a call from New Haven, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a great show. I don't know where I actually come down on this. I must say I'm not very fond of religion, and I saw a bumper sticker once in my life. I didn't make this slogan up. I wish I had. It says, Lord, save me from your followers. And I just I look out in the world today, and I see Judaism and Islam and Christianity. Those three Abrahamic religions are basically about to perhaps destroy the world. I don't know. And then, again, on the other side of the coin, you've had totally godless governments or movements like Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. And look what they did in the name of there is no God.
A very tall pile of bodies there, too. Steve,
yes,
our time
indeed.
Is short. Christopher Hitchens, what do you say to that?
Well, the second point, I should have brought up the second point myself by now. It's not correct to say that the Nazi and fascist regimes were godless. They, all of them, for example, partly came into being by a political concordat with the Vatican.
Well, yes, but...
Yes, and Hitler's birthday was celebrated by order of the German Catholic Church in every Catholic Church in Germany right to the very end. Though Nazism had a pagan element to it, not a secular one, would have liked to replace Christianity with the worship of the Führer in the long run.
And Stalin tore down churches.
Wait a second. I'm coming to communism in a second. And fascism is almost another name for an alliance with the Church. I mean, in fascism in Spain, in Portugal, in Croatia, in Hungary.
We have a minute and a half.
In Slovakia, the leader of the Nazi puppet state was actually a priest in holy orders. Well, with communism. Until 1917 in Russia, millions and millions of Russians have been told for hundreds and hundreds of years that the Tsar was not just the king, the absolute ruler, but he was also the head of the Russian Orthodox Church and something a bit more than divine. Now, if you're Joseph Stalin, by the way, a former seminarian, you're a madman, you're a fool, you shouldn't be in the dictatorship business if you don't exploit this enormous reservoir of belief, of credulity and superstition and backwardness and faith. It's ready-made for you. And you'll be able to create a successful replica of it. That's restating the problem in a different way. Well, he may have tore down churches, but he never dissolved the church. He played the church rather well, actually, as a political ally.
I have to take account of the reality of the clock.
You name me a society. You name me a society that's gone. You name me a society that's gone to hell by following the precepts of Spinoza and Jefferson and Voltaire and Einstein. And Bill, then we'll be talking about a level playing field.
Bill Leonard, theologian, does Christopher Hitchens drive you closer to your faith, or does he put a wedge in there?
Oh, he makes me think about it and worry about it and deal with it in ways that often at least Christianity has swept under the table or just sought to ignore historically. And in that sense, it can be helpful.
Dean Leonard, Bill Leonard at Wake Forest University, thank you very much for being with us. Christopher Hitchens, what's your reception been like? Well, God is not great.
Good heavens. Well, rather like this, the one here that today you so kindly arranged for me, a great deal more positive than most people would be willing to believe.
Thanks for being with us this hour.
Oh, it was very, very, very nice of you to ask me. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.